Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
Wrestling Omakase is back, baby. The weekly podcast that takes you across all the top promotions of the entire Japanese wrestling scene, from New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, DDT, All Japan, Marigold, Dragon Gate, Tokyo Joshi, Sendai Girls, and a whole lot more. I'm John Carroll, a fan of Japanese wrestling for over 20 years, and every week I'm joined by a rotating cast of guest co-hosts as we break down all the top promotions in Japan, men's and women's. Check out Wrestling Omakase right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network today.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day. Gotta let it go. So far. Fast to freedom. Down. Stars tonight together. You and me, while this thing is
welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for August 12th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box to sponsor this podcast, and you can set up a one-time or recurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous sponsors. I'm one of your hosts, it's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside, as always, your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, Dangerous Gate's just, like, Sunday. Like, I know we have, like, made a trend of going, like, well, this one really snuck up on us, but just, Dangerous Gate's on Sunday, and it does not really feel like it's time for that show in a lot of ways.
Well, it was that weird thing where it felt like the time between Kobe World and the next televised show was millions and millions of years in the distance. And then once we got the ball rolling at the end of July, we hit that Corkin. Apologies for the delay on that Corkin written review that is now up on voicesofwrestling.com. Obviously, we did the audio show review on here last week. And you're right, you know, it was very, very quickly Corkin, Kobe, and now we have this pay-per-view. We have a lot to cover tonight. Obviously, Dangerous Gate preview in full effect. We've got a Kobe Sambo Hall match of the year contender. Kobe Sambo Hall, maybe the best match to ever happen in that building contender. Before we dive into Dragon Gate, Mike, I do have another edition of Case's plugs that I would like to get at the top of the show, if that's okay with you.
Would you like me to provide bed music? Or are you okay?
No, you do not need bed music for it. But this is not another Tony Khan interview, but this is the Chicago Indie AAW ran a show this past Saturday that I did color commentary on, which was a ton of fun. And I want to thank Tyler Voles, who's been their play-by-play guy for a number of years, for the invite, and AAW for graciously letting me put on the headset. That show, Take No Prisoners, is not available yet. I believe it will be available this weekend, so we'll probably give it a quick plug next week as well. But very fun, very enjoyable. Hopefully it comes across okay. I had a ton of fun doing it. I don't know if I'll do it again. I was filling in for their usual color guy who was unable to make it. But that is out there. AAW is an indie that has, and I say this as a compliment, a million storylines going on. So if you're somebody that normally doesn't watch that product, I think you might be taken aback by just how much stuff happens on this show, because it's a really newsworthy show. There's a bunch of angles. They set up stuff for next month. There's a, you know, especially at the end of the show, sort of a big thing that happens there. So very enjoyable show to call, very enjoyable promotion to sink my teeth back into, because I had not been keeping up with AAW a ton throughout 2025. But my color commentary will be out, I believe, by this time next week. So we'll talk about it then. But I just want to put that on people's radar.
Yeah, I'll probably have a lot more questions to ask of you after I get a chance to watch it. But I guess the one thing I'll just ask now, you've never done any sorts of like sports broadcasting or anything like that before, right?
No, I've always wanted to. And I just, I have not had the opportunity for all the great opportunities that I've had in my career. So this one jumped out at me as a rare Saturday night where I had no work obligations or nothing really going on. And it worked out nice with the scheduling of it. So it was nice to also get there and for Tyler to go, "Hey, so I call this like a sport. I hope you do the same." And I went, "Yeah, that works for me. I don't really want to do a zany over the top character." So that worked out quite nice.
Yeah, I would have to say it would be a bit of a shock for anyone who's like used to your content, interviews, podcasts, and then suddenly you're debuting like the Halsred Street Preacher case low on commentary.
Yeah, I didn't want to do like I think Don Callis is great in this current role, but I really didn't want to get sucked into that sort of thing. I really just wanted to call it. You know, I still think, and this is maybe surprising to some people, I don't know if people remember this, but I still think my favorite commentary team of all time, and the inspiration that I primarily use when I think about good commentary, is when New Japan on Axis first launched. And this is now 10 years ago, because New Japan on Axis launched right around Wrestle Kingdom 9. But the Mauro Ranallo, Josh Barnett team, which I know if you didn't watch New Japan on Axis, I know that sounds horrible, but their whole deal was calling New Japan like it was a total shoot. Not like, "Hey, we're going to buy into this idea of wrestling being real," but like, "We're going to take our backgrounds in MMA and apply it to New Japan matches." And that might be my favorite stuff. I mean, this is before Mauro became a complete parody of himself. And this is before Barnett became a complete parody of himself. They caught them right at the right window with the right product. So I always really enjoyed that team, but I don't think Tyler and I sounded quite like that, because it's AEW and it's, you know, a promotion that does a lot of brawling and, you know, things like that. But that was my inspiration behind it, was if I could kind of be like Josh Barnett at the beginning of New Japan on Axis, then I would think I would do a good job.
Yeah, I feel like the New Japan on Axis, especially like that initial run, was like the image of Access TV at that time, because you had that and then Inside MMA right afterwards. And Inside MMA, like, this is not here nor there, was basically like the best like profile kind of interview show like about a combat sport that at least was on like on American like major television, as major as you would call Access TV. And I remember just like never really bothering with Access TV outside of it, because it would be like Mark Cuban's bikini destination videos, but
Sammy Hagar's bar show.
Right, yeah, or people playing at the House of Blues in Deep Ellum.
It's funny, because I was just about to say there was a music component to that channel where,
yeah,
because I think the show that they syndicated was just called Rock Legends, and I remember they did a Smiths episode, which is obviously like my whole thing. And it was good and it was well done, and it aired once and I never saw it again. And I've kind of wanted to go back and find that, because, you know, now I know I have, you know, an encyclopedic knowledge on the Smiths, whereas when I would have watched that then, I would have just kind of been getting into them. So I'd like to have eyes on that. But yeah, that Access channel for a while was New Japan and Inside MMA. And then it was at a time in my life, and it's funny, we're recording this the day after the UFC CBS deal was announced, the Paramount deal, and I was talking to my coworker who used to be obscenely into MMA.
Oh, sure.
From, you know, Liddell to maybe the end of Rousey, let's say. And we were talking about just the real estate that UFC used to take up in our lives and how much we enjoyed it. And that would carry over into well, okay, let me watch New Japan on Access on a Friday night, and then, hey, they've got Lion Fight Kickboxing on after this. I'm going to stick around for that. Yeah. Like, those fights were great a lot of the time.
So there is a favorite Twitter character. I'm mostly off the app, but this got brought over to where I diary my consumption of the G1 Climax, where, like, there was this Twitter character that was, like, a very minor figure in Northeastern pro wrestling, but constantly was, like, trying to have, like, YouTube shows.
Okay.
And just completely, like, he was a big Noah and MLW head for, like, whatever reason, because it was pro wrestling done right. And he's now fully onto, like, bare knuckle boxing and, like, bizarre YouTube videos from Ukraine where it's, like, bare knuckle, like, MMA, and it looks like he's being fought in an armory with Catwood with straw bales as, like, the ring. And I'm just I don't know why, but the bringing up the kickboxing show immediately put me into rediscovering this Twitter character yesterday, and I appreciate that case because it's very funny to me.
Yeah, look, I wish for two things. I wish that, one, I was remotely interested in MMA at this point, and I wish that, much like the largest pro wrestling organization in America, I wish that the largest MMA organization in America wasn't an extension of far-right politics at this point. But that's the world that we're living in, and it's a super depressing world a lot of the time. So I don't love it, you know. I'm somebody who's very much on the, like, companies are evil, you know, it sucks, but what are you gonna do? And then I watch the way they operate, and I go, this is an evil company. This is, I hate everybody here.
Yeah, it like TKO getting about $15 billion across like the last 40 hours, and then now it's announced that, like, Zuffa Boxing is going to go to Paramount too, and that's the Saudi Boxing League with Dana White.
I'm telling you, like, we're 1 year away from Saudi Arabia, you know, funding Rutgers football or Penn State or, you know, Texas or whoever.
That's the big fear about the NBA, right? That they'd have to get, like, this World League or NBA Europe spun up as fast as possible, because they think that LeBron and Maverick are going to go Saudi money afterwards.
I think there's legitimate possibilities there. I mean, I know people.
Seeing what the PIF has gotten into, and something that I was at one point incredibly into in esports completely, like, it can even be more overwhelming than it is. And that basketball league could be that.
I think rightfully so. You know, people's mileage may vary on Bill Simmons. I'm, you know, three times a week rewatchable. You know, I consume everything that he puts out, but I understand why he's not everybody's cup of tea all the time. But there are certain things that are really in his wheelhouse, in the same way that every show, they have things that are really in their wheelhouse. And one of his things lately has been, don't ignore whatever this secondary basketball league could be. This is far more realistic and a far bigger threat, not to be a 1A, 1B, but to be a real thorn in the side of the NBA than I think some serious people are making it out to be. And that kind of falls in line of something that I trust him on. So it's very much on my radar. My antennas are up on it. And as the league, the NBA being, you know, went from full on, like, hey, we're ready to expand, bring us Vegas, bring us Seattle, to now it seems like there's a very loud group of owners saying that we don't want expansion, because God forbid they share any of the billions of dollars that they're making owning a sports team. That is going to put LeBron in a bad position, because LeBron's whole exit strategy has been being a part owner of whatever this Vegas NBA team ends up being. And if there's not a Vegas NBA team, that's not a guy that's going to sit idly by for a long time. So I don't know what's going to happen there.
Yeah, and especially just with, like, the global basketball world, from the way I understand it, is, like, uniquely fragmented in such a way that where LIV Golf was able to capitalize really on the amount of money that was going around the PGA coming out before it, and that encouraging PGA to basically first fund up and then get absorbed with it. It really feels like to me that you have NBA as, like, this one trying to be, like, a cultural monolith when you already have, like, these established clubs in Europe, and then the leagues in China and in Japan that are just growing at such a precipitous rate that, like, it's the one, like, major sport, like, that there can be that external threat, at least as it relates to the United States sports landscape, at least as the way I look at it.
I find every facet of basketball, which is my favorite sport, sport I care about most, sport I follow the closest. I find every facet of basketball in America, from the way that we develop players to the way that it's played to the way that we talk about basketball, I find all of it to be completely and utterly broken right now. And I think a lot of that falls at the feet of Adam Silver and some of the things that he lets people, whether it be players, organizations, or media partners, get away with. But it's a completely broken system in America right now. And while there's, you know, I don't have any short-term or long-term concerns about the NBA as an entity, because I think that'd be foolish.
Oh, yeah.
To
no if there's
a secondary league that can develop a trustworthy pipeline to European players, which is where all of the best basketball players are coming out of right now. It's mm-hmm. Europe and Canada. You know, I mean, the Canadian national team is unbelievable. It's going to be really interesting to see. It's a top-down issue. I mean, it's literally from youth basketball to talking head basketball shows. I don't think they're doing much of anything right now. And Adam Silver seems asleep at the wheel on some of this stuff, and I find that to be very interesting. I mean, oddly enough, you know, the thing people complain about most is the style of play, and I largely find that to be old men yelling at clouds. The style of play is the least of basketball's concerns in America right now. It's everything surrounding it that I think is a much bigger issue.
Yeah, no, it's such a, like, a just like morass that, like, even as someone from like Dallas Fort Worth, like, there's like the whole like thing going on. It's like, oh, how did we get this number one draft pick?
It's absolutely sickening. It's absolutely, you guys did not deserve that. Now, no, you guys didn't deserve what happened with Luka, but you also didn't deserve Cooper Flagg.
No. So, like, you have like all of this like serpent like scuttlebutt happening, and then, like, you're absolutely right, like the European pipeline, like the one thing that the reason why the clubs always work out is because that in Europe is because they already have like the giant established academy systems for like football. So, like, when Luka, just because this is like the clear obvious example, ends up at Real Madrid at 13, you're able to actually like develop it there in that sort of context, and there's no way to develop anything like that in the United States in the established framework. So the one simple answer is, who's going to exploit it? And the answer probably will end up being the PIF.
Yeah, I think that's well put. But we have a lot of Durangate to get into. I want to start with this main event on the Kobe Samba Hall show. I guess we can blitz through the first four matches if we need to. But we have what I would deem to be a very special match at our feet right now.
Yeah, so this summer festival show that they had in Kobe on Monday, I have to say, I'm just going to run through, take 10 seconds to go through like the everything up until the things that are going to really be playing out across this show. And then later into September, we had Kazuma Kimura's first match in Kobe against Yoshiki Kato. Yoshiki Kato got it, the win at the Caldera Luna in 8 minutes. Ho-Ho Lun, Ho-Ri, and Reach Tomonaga versus Super Shenlong 2, Super Shenlong 3, and Sachi Hoko Machine. Ho-Ho Roll on Machine. Ultimo and Takashi versus Don Fuji and Kanda. That was Takashi with a Pineapple Bomber on Kanda. Battle of Mochizuki Dojo. Ryu Fuda gets the win over Daiki Yanagiuchi. Mochi was with Fuda. Sahara was with Daiki. It was Fuda with his ripcord knee. That's called the Seiruto. And then the Miyani authorized Battle Royal was won by Kai, which then the winner of the Battle Royal was revealed by our close personal friend of the show, Seiji Miyane, to be the person who has to face off against Diakashino Dino at Gata Miyane in September. And that led us right into our semi-main and our main event. Semi-main, Madoka Kakuta versus Hamari. And then the real special thing here, the Summer Festival special, six-man tag, three-way match, Love and Peace, Benkei, Jackie Kamei, and Rita versus D-Courage, Yuki Yoshioka, Dragon Dai, and Ryo Yatsunaka versus Team Mexico, Flamita, Luis Monte, and Bendito. And what we have to, like, what I want to, like, start off discussion this asking is, Case, what matches has this company had in this building that were much better than this one?
So this is what I was thinking about
as today went along, and you have the immediate contender for March 30th of this year, Himari and Shun Skywalker versus Jackie Kame and Rita, because I believe we came on here after that show, after that match, and we're like, man, this feels like it's one of the best Kobe Sambo Hall matches of all time.
No,
that was
absolutely.
This year. You know, I mean, also on that show was the Himari and Shun versus Jason and Kota Minoru match, but that's on the level we're talking about. I think Himari and Shun versus Kame and Rita is approaching the level that we're talking about. I think you have to mention Kame versus SB Kento, which is, you know, a pretty infamous match for a number of reasons at this point, but I would comfortably put the main event of this most recent show ahead of that. The other two that I thought of, and I have to thank Angry216 in the Discord, because I did a command find with all of his match of the weeks that he's been doing at the Dragon Gate channel, which he's been doing for literally years now. But I did the search function to figure out which match of the weeks he's done from Kobe Sambo Hall. And there were two there that jumped out to me, one of which was T-Hawk versus Masaki Mochizuki, January 12th, 2014. That was one of the first really great T-Hawk singles matches. That was one that in real time I remember eating up, and it's one that I think has aged quite well. Very much not a Dragon Gate style match. It was, you know, it's the type of thing that when you look back at it now, you see why there was perhaps so much tension within the Dragon Gate universe and the fans between T-Hawk and literally any other wrestler, because that's kind of a Noah match done in a Dragon Gate ring and Dragon Gate's home venue. But it is an excellent match if you like that sort of thing. And then the other one that I thought of was, oddly enough, also featuring T-Hawk, but it was fake Naoki Tanizaki against real Naoki Tanizaki in the Loser Leaves Town match in Kobe Sambo Hall. That one I remember just for the spectacle of it being really entertaining, really engaging. But, you know, we're talking about kind of a storyline heavy match. So just from the ones that I could think of off the top of my head, and obviously if I'm forgetting some, I'm going to throw it to you. If we're forgetting some, please let us know. Open the Voice Gate channel on the Voices of Wrestling Discord. I would love to have a greater list of these. But, man, this kind of feels like it might be the best match we've ever seen in this building.
And I think that it's fair to, like, also state that this building for Dragon Gate has really ebbed and flowed with time and what they would do in this building. And I think there's no other ways to mince the words. The amount of effort that was displayed. And I think that this, the like having all of these somewhat recent matches and then a couple of matches back in 2011 kind of state that, because there was this big kind of period where this was a very sloggy venue for the promotion. And I feel like really starting actually during that empty arena COVID show that they would have there, the first one, that it kind of coming out of COVID, this became a venue where it started to have a lot more life in it. And that really, I think, lends credence to like the better, at least, work rate matches in the history of Kobe Sambo Hall being more likely in the last 4 years.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, you know, there's a period of maybe 2013 through 2015, 2016, where this is, you know, an enjoyable venue that had a number of really good matches. I think back to, you know, Genki versus Super Shisa and some of the stuff they were doing more with mid-carders, and then, you know, some Monster Express, Matt Blanky stuff that I really like coming out of this building. But yeah, by the time the calendar turns to 2017, there's a definitely a 2 year run there. Cause as time goes on, I look back more and more fondly on the year of 2019 that Dragon Gate had. And I kind of think in hindsight, that's a year that has held up really, really well. But you know, your 2017, 2018 Kobe Sambo Hall shows are borderline unwatchable. I mean, they're some of the weakest shows that this promotion ever taped and released. So you can strike literal years from the record in this conversation and go to, okay, well, what were they doing in 2011 with the Blood Warriors Junction 3 stuff? What were they doing in 2013? Again, I always go back to that Genki Shisa match. 2014, again, there's some Monster Express and Millennials and Matt Blanky stuff that I like here, but it's a pretty short list. You know, there's never been a Dreamgate match in this building. There's been very few title matches other than Bravegate matches in this building, and even then the Bravegate matches are few and far between. So it's a building that's produced, you know, a lot of great matches, but very few high level matches quite like this one.
Yeah, and I think getting into the match itself, you really have multiple factors into a match that I think that whenever we watch three-way matches outside of other promotions, we kind of are already spoiled, because usually when Dragon Gate does these matches and they do the two falls to a finish, it's something completely different, and it's always nice to kind of see the new innovation of the three-way match. And you got to really kind of see it just to launch the discussion. Is Jackie Kamei the most acrobatically gifted and precise wrestler working today?
Well, Mike, I know he's the most under-pushed wrestler on the planet, and I'm now fully convinced that unless we see a sweeping change by the end of the year, that he's the guy that should win most underrated in the Observer Awards. Because I mean, look, I'm going to have to do it again this week. I'm going to have to do a whole Love and Peace thing. It was already trending in that direction just based on the way that Hyo was treated in that battle royal. And then this main event happened, and it was just like, oh my God, what are we doing with these guys? What are we missing? But to go back to your point before I go on a whole Love and Peace thing about just, I don't know what they've done. I don't know who hates them. I don't know why they aren't Twin Gate, Triangle Gate, Brave Gate champions. Whatever the combination you want to make it. I don't understand it. But is Kamei the most athletically gifted wrestler going today? Is that what you asked?
Acrobatically, because I think athletics, that's such a broad kind of thing, and it's not like a certain thing, though. Someone could probably say, oh, look at how fast Callum Newman is in the ring. Isn't that more athletic than Jackie Kamei's command of body control? So that's why I chose acrobatic, basically.
The only person that comes to mind is, I still think, even as his in-ring style has evolved and changed and he's bulked up and he's gone from junior to middleweight to now full-on heavyweight, Ospreay does some stuff acrobatically that just floors me. You know, the body control that Ospreay has, the way that he can land on his feet out of any position, it seems like, he's the only guy I give the edge to. But you know, it's like the dirty little secret of this podcast, where when Kamei has been really on over the last few years, it coincides with this historically great, now all-time great run that Will Ospreay is on. And as Ospreay continues to build that pedigree, I find all of his detractors to be dumber and dumber and dumber. But, you know, by and large, for as long as Kamei's career has existed, Ospreay's been the best wrestler in the world. And when we talk about Kamei at the peak of his powers, in whatever situation that is, whether it's a Brave Gate match, whether it's a Twin Gate match, whether it's something like this, my usual take is he's in the best wrestler of the world conversation for everybody other than Ospreay and Danielson. And we saw that with Kamei in this match, where it's just like, he's everything that I want out of specifically a Dragon Gate wrestler, but I wish wrestling, instead of just stealing the pace and the moves of Dragon Gate, would steal all the other things. It's kind of the Eddie Guerrero syndrome, where they're stealing the worst parts of Eddie Guerrero and just ruining Eddie Guerrero's legacy. We've hit a little bit of that point with Dragon Gate. With Kamei, I watch this guy, and yeah, the only guy that I can think is maybe more acrobatically gifted than him right now that I can think of off the top of my head is Will Ospreay.
And with Will, we know that his body control is like, in spite of the amount of miles and damage he has on him, which I think is its own remarkable thing in of itself. That fact that now, really 12 years after he really exploded, he's still having that kind of level of precision when a lot of the other wrestlers of his ilk have kind of completely shied away from that by and large. Like, I mean, the other person would be Ricochet, like 2010 through 2014, but now you see by the end of 2014, Ricochet is putting away the double moonsault, not necessarily being more pointed with his flying, but not necessarily flying for flying's sake. So I feel like that's where the lineage goes, right?
If we're talking peaks, then yeah, I mean, Ricochet has done some stuff that I've never seen another human do. Pac has done some stuff that I've never but Jack's I find what Kamei does to be so much more impressive than what Jack does. And I like Jack. You know, it's not a dig on him. Sure. But
it's the Sabu aspect.
And it kind of goes back to, you know, oddly enough, you know, Ricochet asked that question on Twitter yesterday about who the best high flyers were of all time. And, you know, there were some answers there. It's like, I don't really consider Hayabusa to be in that conversation. And I largely don't consider Liger to be in that category. You know, this is the podcast that a month ago did the like, hey, I think historically we're underrating Liger, so it's not a dig on Liger.
but he's not that style.
Yeah, look at him like that, which is maybe a me thing. Maybe I'm wrong for that, but
the further your point, like you don't think about Kobashi being a flyer whatsoever nowadays or throughout his historical career. And same about Muto, even though that they were doing moonsaults for decades at a time, you know? Like, and I feel like
Liger's probably in the middle ground between doing a moonsault and then being a full-blown junior heavyweight. But, this is the conundrum that I have when I watch Kame. Is I'm looking at this guy and the body of work that he's racked up since 2021, and the high-end stuff that he has is alarmingly high end. And I know that he doesn't get the credit that he deserves, but part of that is because his own company won't fucking push him. And I don't get it. Like, this is the benefit of having Kame in match six or match seven instead of in match two or match three, is you're gifted things like this. It did not take a genius to put this match together, but it took a handful of geniuses in the ring. And I would put Kame on that level. I would put Flamito when he's really cooking on that level. You know, that they made this match what it was. And I am completely blown away now this deep into his career. Again, you know, Jay told the story on commentary at Corkin where Kimura was largely inspired to become a wrestler by watching Kame and SB Kento in Kobe Sambo Hall. He's not a rookie anymore. He is somebody that you can take the training wheels completely off.
He's getting his 5-year anniversary in 5 months.
Exactly. Take the bicycle away. Give him a dirt bike. You know, let this guy ride off into the sunset.
He does have a little bit of Gideon gemstone that I do think he can maybe pull off some sweet dirt bike tricks. The one other thing that just kind of appeared to me as we were talking about this and about like the promotion and Kame's kind of position as this unique acrobatic wrestler. You know, like this gets into something we were talking about a few weeks ago. Maybe Kame is just in the wrong era of Dragon Gate, because if he comes around 15 years before, he's going to be blowing people's minds at PWG because those trips were happening then. And then just from his Barbarian Overlords music video clips, like that would have been like another generation of wrestlers that probably got inspired like Kimura to become a wrestler if Kame just got into a time machine and went back to 2010.
You're 1,000,000% right. And I've never really thought about that aspect of it before, but that reminds me of the conversation we had coming out of Mania Weekend about the insulation that we're suffering from now. You know, we have access to everything. Absolutely, and so nobody's watching anything. But we made the point about the Panther Brothers match from Mania Weekend, where that is the type of match, which I believe has happened zero times since Mania Weekend, which is a whole other conversation. But, you know, that's the type of match where if it happens 10 years ago, they go to every indie, they do the touring match, it's largely the same match, and it's diminishing returns for people like us that are going to watch everything. But now you have the benefit of, if you're going to do the Panther Brothers tag, they can do that in California, they could do it in Vegas, they could do it in Chicago, they could do it in Florida, they can do it in Mexico, they could do it on the East Coast, and it's the cross-pollination is not there. We're a little bit tighter in what we're watching, a little bit more focused in what we're watching, despite having more access than ever. And Kame is one of the real losers of this spread out content ecosystem, because I don't even think, like, the reputation that Shun Skywalker has, just because he's Shun Skywalker, people might not watch Dragon Gate, but they know that Shun Skywalker is a good wrestler. Kame is not even close to that. The general New Japan fan, English-speaking American New Japan fan that suffered through the G1 and then got nothing at the end of it, that's somebody that I think has enough knowledge to go, okay, I don't know Dragon Gate, but I know Shun Skywalker. I think that guy's cool. And there's no reason that Kame shouldn't be the next name that they mention. And I really think, not that he will ever be a Dreamgate champion, not that he should ever be a Dreamgate champion, not that he's going to headline Kobe World, not that he should ever headline Kobe World, but I do think we are gravely missing the boat with this guy's card placement. And we're just going to, I think we're just going to have this conversation year after year after year, because I don't see, if you don't see it now at a time, which, you know, we'll preview Dangerous Gate. And look, I think they've killed the build on this pay-per-view. I think this is going to be a great show. I was listening to Rich and Joe talk about AEW business last week and about how they've done all these things that their fan base seems to want. They're having good TV show after good TV show. Now we're waiting to see the cruise ship turn. It takes a long time for the cruise ship to turn, but we're waiting for the steering wheel to change direction, let alone the boat turn. And I'm listening to that segment, and I'm having the same thoughts about Dragon Gate, because at least from what we can tell online, the advance for these Danger Skate tickets are not very good. It's a little concerning to me, actually. And so I'm not saying that pushing Kame into a title match guaranteed on every big show that you have is going to turn around business. I think that's an insane leap to make. I don't think anybody's trying to make that. I just want to be very clear. But if you don't see it now, and if you didn't see it in 2024, and you didn't see it in 2023, and you didn't see what he did for you during the mess that was 2022, I'm not sure you'll ever see it. This doesn't feel like a Yoshiki Kato thing where I keep on telling everybody, and we saw it on this show, where it's like, everybody relax on Kato. That guy's going to be fine. It's just not his time specifically right now. The Kame thing, I'm going, maybe it's just never going to happen, because I don't know what else he can do.
I mean, and I really loathe to kind of even speak the word of it. I mean, it makes you wonder backstage, frankly. Like, I loathe to bring that up, but like, the proof is in the pudding with this guy. He should be essentially, for what Dragon Kid was in 2006 through 2013, as like that figure for Dragon Gate internationally, or just in general as like that kind of marketed figure, they seem to have completely just dismissed it out of hand. And it's like, no, he's a good hand that we know can really heat things up and pull things together in these kinds of matches. Because like, what you're describing about us coming back and doing like this conversation every year probably would have been like what would have happened if Open the Voice Gate existed in 2006 and we're talking about Super Shisa, you know? Like, that's what I'm kind of wondering right now.
I think there's a ton of truth to that. I think back of like, okay, for most of the 2010s, if Yamato wasn't Dreamgate champion, he was Twin Gate champion. And if he wasn't Twin Gate champion, he was Triangle Gate champion. And I'm just trying to figure out why Kame's not, if he's not Brave Gate champion, he's Twin Gate champion. If he's not Twin Gate champion, he's Triangle Gate champion. I'm trying to figure out what I'm missing here, because it just seems like this is the type of thing. And again, it's purely a reflection of his output. It's the bigger position this guy's in, the more memorable his matches are. We're talking about a guy who's been involved in literally some of the greatest matches in this promotion's history, and then there's never a follow-up.
Yeah, this is the guy that, at least as it pertains to buildings within Kobe, he has the, right now, arguably the best match in Kobe Sambo Hall history, and he has the best match in Kobe World Kenan Hall history that we're talking about there. So it's not just, oh, he's great in this building. Like, if you go up and down, and if you're talking about wrestlers in this promotion having the best match, and more often than not, you might see Jackie Kame. Like, another, just how the company views him versus how the ball talkers view him. All right. I am right now looking at the poster for Dangerous Gate coming up on Sunday. Of course, as we kind of expected, who's first and foremost on this poster case? It's Shun Skywalker.
As
we all knew
be.
This. We all knew that the second that Yamato lost the belt, he'd be the one first and foremost in the same position as him, slightly smaller to his sides. Yamato, Kakuta, Benkei, Daya, Hyo, Strong Machine J. Other people who aren't like in like just profile photos: Rioya Tanaka, Ultimo, Susumu, Kota Minora, Ishin, Yuki Yoshioka, Dragon Kid, KZ, and Luis Monte. Jackie Kamei is wedged in like the profile photo portion right next between Ryu Fuda and UT.
Not great.
So I think that's something that kind of puts it into a little bit of stark comparison. Someone else I want to talk about this match.
I've got a ton to say on this match. I've got way more. But I do want to stay on this for 1 second. If you go to Cage Match and you go to Kame's top 10 matches rated by the inmates, it's Diamante and Shun versus Kame and Jason from World. That's an 8.86. Right? Well-deserved. Best match of his career. I don't think anybody would argue. It is then the Hyo contra Hyo match from earlier this year, which is at an 8.79. The Twin Gate 4-Way from last Kobe World, this would be 2024, at an 8.48. There is this match. Oh, I'm sorry. This is actually... No, this is... Oh, this is the Triangle Gate match from Kobe World this year, which is sitting at an 8.19. That feels too high. That's not great. And then after that, Kame versus Kento from Korakuen at an 8. Dia and Kakuta versus Kame and Jason from Dangerous Gate 2022 at a 7.88. Flamita and Monte versus Kame and Rita from last December, Korakuen 7.87. The cage match from last year, in which Kame was obviously one of the main characters, 7.78. Kame, KZ, and UT versus Ishida, Minoru, and Doi from Champion Gate 2022. That's a match I went 4.75 on. Cage match has it a 7.78. And then your 10th match was the Kobe Samba Hall match between Kame and Kento, which is at a 7.77. So I think they're underrating some of the matches in that top 10. Largely, my top 10 would look the same. And that is a pretty spectacular top 10 match resume.
Yeah, and if you put up against probably anyone in the promotion across that time period, with the exception of Yamato and Shun Skywalker, and maybe including those two, to be quite honest, would he be number one? I think he probably would be.
I think Shun would be number one. I think his catalog is absurd when you go back and look at the totality of it. But it would be maybe Shun, KZ, Kame, or Shun, Kame, KZ, and then Yamato in that order. But it's That's the level of greatness that we're dealing with here. I don't find that to be hyperbolic at all. I find it to be completely baffling that he has that track record that he does. But after almost all of those matches, there's no, this happened and it led to this. It was just this happened. It was great. We all celebrated it. And then he was opening match next month.
Yeah. And I just hope that one day that would not be the case. Yuki Yoshioka in this match, it looks like he's already starting to put back on the mask, so maybe he had a bug or something. I know they've kind of been around each other when both guys were kind of on top, but the chemistry that Benkei and Yoshioka showed in like their stretch towards the end really kind of makes me wonder, like, is that maybe a King of Gate semifinal or final match this year? Because it feels like that there's a level of chemistry there that has not been tapped into recently. And I thought Yoshioka, like, it remains the funniest thing that the two guys that it feels like that Tanahashi has put over so far are like Waimora and Yuki Yoshioka. And Yuki Yoshioka is the one walking around with the high fly flow, but he was great in this.
Yeah, it's a largely unexplored bit of chemistry between those two. Obviously, same class, two heavyweights. I'm all for it. I thought of the nine guys in this match, I thought Yoshioka was the ninth best, which is, in a match like this, not an insult in the way that it sounds, but more just an observation that Bendito. Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about Bendito, and I in just a minute, I want to go through. I've highlighted, this is not a podcast that ever goes move by move through matches, and we're not going to go move by move, but I've got a bunch of spots I want to rattle off here. Bendito's in a number of them. I was thinking about Bendito because he's got a Noah booking this weekend too, and it's just like, man, you know what, good for him. What a trip this has turned out to be. He's a champion in Dragon Gate. I think he's going to have a successful defense this weekend, and now Noah's bringing him in for a date as well, so good on Bendito. But Yoshioka, again, maybe this is just the weekly sports talkification of covering Dragon Gate that I'm falling guilty to here. It's not that I think he looks bad. I'm far less concerned about his long-term prospects than I was, say, even 2 months ago. but he is a step slower. He does not have the snap all the time that some of the other guys have. Sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't. Sometimes in this match he had it, sometimes he didn't. My laser focus is directed at Yoshioka. I thought he was the ninth best guy in this match of nine guys.
That's fair. That's fair. And especially like when you think about these kinds of matches, someone like Benkei was an absolute just hellion doing all the Benkei things. And they really lend themselves to like these kinds of sprint section intensive matches. And Yoshioka has just never been that kind of guy, to be honest.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
No. I would agree with that.
But Ben was just devastating in this. But I really want to talk about Bendito because I thought that this was easily like, of course, this might be the best match in this building's history. This is this guy's best match in Dragon Gate so far to date. Just like maybe it is finding out the spots and like him getting the confidence and, you know, eventually getting up to speed with it. But just like you have someone like Jackie Kamei who was using him and Luis Monte as human jungle gyms throughout this match, but I just kind of like whereas you felt like Yoshioka was the ninth person in this match, Monte kind of felt that way a little bit for me. But I thought
Monte had a stellar performance in this match. Monte hit a drop kick on Benkei at one point that I thought caved in his chest cavity. Monte was so stiff in a match that doesn't normally warrant stiffness. I was blown. The Monte thing is another puzzling one where they have just killed that guy's aura, and it's partially Monte's fault. I don't think he's totally figured out how to gain back the charisma that he lost by losing the mask. And at this point, it's 2 years of Monte being unmasked, which is insane to say. But it has been 2 years, and I think a little bit of that falls on him. I think a lot of that falls on the company's booking, though. But I thought Monte was stellar in this match.
All right, that's fair. That's fair.
Let me run through just some spots here.
Some spots.
So I watched this match twice. I gotta say, I don't know the last time. Maybe it might have been Kame and Kento from 2021. The last time that I had people reaching out to me all day before I had a chance to watch a Kobe Sambo Hall show going like, hey, you need to watch this. I had people in the building telling me that. I had people in the Discord telling me that. I had people DMing me on Twitter telling me that. I was like, hey, you gotta get on this. We gotta get your thoughts on this. So I watched this match once, unspoiled, didn't know who won, and didn't take any notes. Just watched it to watch it, had a blast, was pacing around my apartment afterwards just thinking like, holy shit, that is everything that I want out of pro wrestling. Watched it a second time today, right before we started recording, and did my usual notes on it. And then after I was done with those notes, which is mostly not move by move, but impactful move by impactful move, I then highlighted the ones that really stuck with me afterwards. So I'm just going to rifle through these and then I'll throw it to you if there's anything that you want to comment on, anything that you feel like I missed. But Rita launching into a springboard head scissors on Flamita while holding Ryo Tanaka's hand. He was doing the little rope bounce spot. He does the head scissors on Flamita. They then trade arm drags in a three-way dance style and then do the three-way dropkick standoff. That was the best version of that spot maybe I've ever seen, of three guys that were totally in sync, a super high spot that led to the three-way dance stuff. I really liked that. There is then, immediately afterwards, Kame doing the barrel roll, 360 twist arm drag from the top rope to Bendito. Bendito was in a perfect spot. He took a great bump. Fantastic stuff there. Love and Peace do their version of what I always call the crazy max spot, where they build a pyramid on the guy.
That was probably one of my favorite spots of the match. Yeah.
And I don't know if there's, I would love to know if there's an official term for that. I think a lot of people probably associate it with Kaientai DX. I associate it with Crazy Max.
I think about the colony because that was their finish.
Maybe that's a Gran Akuma question. I don't know if there's an official name for that spot.
I would love to know what that official name is, and he would be the one who would know that.
Yeah, because I always just call it the Crazy Max, but they're doing the pyramid spot. Monte is slapping Rita in the face at the top of the pyramid. Rita then leaps off, goes for Hurricanrana. Monte catches him and power bombs Rita into Jahikame. That is outstanding stuff. Then you go a little bit further into the match. I referenced Crazy Max a second ago. Now I'm going to reference what I call the blood generation spot, which is when Monte took Daya and Tanaka by the legs, held them by the legs, and had them draped over the rope, and Flamita did the leapfrog over Monte onto D Courage, which is like, I always just associate that as the blood generation. That was kind of how they got their heat, but they do that. I've never seen it done on two people at once. I thought that was absolutely fantastic, and that bleeds into a series of strikes where Team Mexico looked like they were murdering Kame in the middle of the ring. And credit to Bendito, that sequence ends with him nailing his step-up springboard swanton onto Kame. He goes for a pin. Ben K breaks up the pin by doing the gut-wrench deadlift that we've seen him do a million times, but this time he does it onto Bendito, which was absolutely fantastic. Then the match does not stop there. You go to Kame, who does the craziest spot of the match, which is like
this Super Rana.
Yeah, well, it was like what I have down on my notes, and this is a poor interpretation of the move. I saw that the video was making its rounds on Blue Sky. I don't know if it's on Twitter at all, but Kame bounced off the ropes, Bendito popped him up in the air, and Kame did like a 360 wheelbarrow pin that he's done a version of this spot before, but it's never been this intense or athletically superior before. He does that, goes for the pin, Bendito kicks out, Bendito kills him with a super kick. That sets up Rita to do the top rope crucifix bomb onto Bendito. They nail it. Fantastic stuff there. But unlike the match at Kobe World, which I thought kind of died a death after that first fall. Oh, why is that? Oh, because they eliminated Love and Peace. They keep Love and Peace in the match. And the final section of this that was Love and Peace and D Courage, I don't think slowed down at all. You have Kame and Rita doing the double middle rope bulldog onto Yoshioka. Yoshioka gets up and then eats the Benkei missile dropkick. I thought that was excellent. Ben does a vicious spear on Ryoya Tanaka. He goes for one on Daya, and then Daya's the one that does the knee strike counter in a Benkei spear, which I don't think Daya's ever done before. Kame then does the insane springboard middle rope Hurricanrana. We've seen Dragon Kid do this move a million times. I don't think he's ever done it like Kame did it in this match. And then that leads into the high fly flow when we have our finish. 4¾ stars. It is my number two Dragon Gate match of the year behind Shun Skywalker and Yamato. I don't know. This might be better than Hyo contra Hyo. It is definitely better than Yamato versus KZ, which is the other Dragon Gate match that I had at 4¾ within the second WrestleMania weekend six-man tag, which I might have as my vanity pick at number 10 this year. But now we're talking about a longer list of 4¾ star matches this year. And if this is not my number two, it's my number three Dragon Gate match of the year.
And even I feel like we're getting close to like the two-third point of 2025. Feels like just from you rattling that all off, that match work wise, like this year is going to go down as one of the top ones just from like the first 8 months alone, just because I remember like 2023, 2024, we'd have one or two four and three quarter stars matches. But I mean, it really is a statement where I'm listening to you list them off. I'm like, oh yeah, no, that one too. And it's just like re-jogging in my mind the kind of insanity of Dragon Gate's year, when that WrestleMania six man is probably going to end up being like the fifth or sixth best match in the promotion all year. And I think I figured out a special tell for modern Jackie Kamei, if you know a match is going off, by the way. Oh, that
okay.
I wanted to jump in while you were saying this, but you actually somehow managed to, I have 11 lines of notes on this match. You managed to run through seven of them right there during that. But whenever Kamei gets power bombed onto someone, that's when you know things are picking up. That's when you can kind of like sit back in your seat, put down the phone, because you know you're in for a Jackie Kamei special, I feel like.
I think that's a good litmus test. On the comment of Dragon Gate's in-ring in totality this year, I think their high-end stuff is going to be higher than the last few years. I don't think this year has had...
There's no RED versus Torimon Generation Disbands match that's going to come out, right?
No. But I still think, you know, on the whole, I mean, let me pull up my spreadsheets from these last 2 years, because I think the highest end stuff this year is going to beat out the last few years. I think where this year's lacked has been the really fun four-star match in Fukuoka and the really fun four-star match, you know, in Kobe, let's say. The low end stuff has been there, but I don't think it's been as consistent as it was. So 2023, my top three, these were all 4¾ stars, was Skywalker Kakuta, which again I think is a super underrated match. The cage match, and then one of my favorite Twin Gate matches of all time, Kano and Kondo versus Susumu Mochizuki and Yasushi Kanda. And then last year, my top three were Daya Kakuta Tanaka, Isha Minoru Skywalker, KZ Strong Machine JUT. That was from the last Korakuen of 2024. And then the other two that I had were the Reide Parejas Finals, Dragon Kid and Doi versus Susumu and Yamato, and then Mochizuki versus Mochizuki. So when you look at this year, 2023 and 2024, I had two... I'm sorry. 2023 and 2024, I had 3 4¾ star matches each. This year, I already have 5, and I like the high-end stuff from this year way more than I like the high-end stuff from 23 and 24.
Yeah, like that's kind of where I kind of came to that point there, going like, I think I'm going to remember a lot of stuff from this year a lot more than previous. But I think the special thing also about this summer festival show, 3 hours, which is really long for a Kobe Sambo Hall show, but even with the length, a lot of Seiji Miyane, and it ended up, at least for me, I would probably at certain points, if I knew I could get like the J translation, or if I just kind of know whether to kind of go, I'll fast forward and get ready the next match. But the on this show, going from the Royal Sambo to Kakuta versus Hamari, Kakuta absolutely demolishes Hamari like from the jump. And then within 2 minutes, Shun Skywalker emerges from the crowd, distracts him. Hamari hits the Momo latch. And then you have like a 15-minute promo with Seiji Miyane with Shun Skywalker that I was just riveted by. Shun was like grabbing chairs, standing up in the middle of the crowd, and Miyane was just all the while just kind of bemused by it all. And in the way that it plays into the Dangerous Gate main event, it really kind of felt like maybe giving a little bit of hope to Shun before a match where there's a part of me that really wants Shun to win at Dangerous Gate, even though I think Kakuta is the person, and we talked last week about wanting to see maybe a little bit of a long heel tenure with the belt coming up. But I just really ended up enjoying this entire summer festival show from yesterday. I just thought it was a great time all throughout.
I thought it was a very good show. I found what they did with Kakuta and Hamari was just real quick on that. It was 2 minutes of Kakuta demolishing Hamari, and then Shun ran in with the distraction. Hamari was able to get the win. I thought that was really well done. So it's a show where you can skip through intermission and watch the last two matches, and I think be fully caught up on everything you need to get to before Dangerous Gate, with the main event again being, I think, completely and utterly essential if you're doing match of the year bounding this year. Because the other thing, and I sent this match out to some people yesterday, and I hope kind of as the week goes on more people pay attention to it, but I talked about, you know, the Dragon Gateification of wrestling a little bit ago, and how it's, you know, I find it to be the same thing as the Eddie Guerrero tributes, where they're taking sort of the easiest parts to take from, and they're losing the things that make either that promotion or that wrestler special when they do these tributes. You know, wrestling now just looks like Dragon Gate. I just think a lot of the time it looks like a worse version of Dragon Gate than what Dragon Gate's doing. There is still no promotion that can do this match. And for all of the evolution of the in-ring style, for the great matches that AEW has, for the great wrestlers they have, for as great as CMLL has been this year, whatever promotion you want to look at, Dragon Gate is still the only promotion that can do this, and that is why it's such a special match to people like you and I.
Yeah, just really special and phenomenal. But we have Dangerous Gate coming up on Sunday, and we talked a little bit about it last week, but we really want to take the remainder of the show to give a big and honest preview about it, and we've kind of talked around it, but the main event, Shun Skywalker versus Madoka Kakuta, we've seen how the company really has, as soon as the bell rang at Kobe World this year, this was on the radar and they were building to it. Is there any way in your mind, Case, that Shun Skywalker walks out of Oda Ward on Sunday as Dreamgate champion?
I do think there's a possibility. I'm still kind of the belief that maybe it's not 50-50, but Kakuta's going to be favored, but I don't think Skywalker's a dark horse candidate to leave with the belt. I would not be surprised if he's Dreamgate champion come the next time we record. I wouldn't bet on it. Even with the odds, and a chance to make great money, I would not bet on Skywalker retaining the title, but I don't think it's impossible by any means.
Yeah, Skywalker retained the title would be the last leg of a five-match parlay. Then that's the one you're hoping that would really be the modifier to cash in on, right?
Yes, and I think it's interesting that as you look through this Dreamgate stuff, part of the charm with this Yamato reign was, okay, we knew it was going to be Kakuta, we knew it was going to be Ishin, we knew it was going to be Kano. Daya was a little up in the air. Strong Machine J was a little up in the air, and then we knew he was going to beat KZ, we knew he was going to beat Jason, we knew he was going to be Mochi, but the Shun Skywalker match was really anybody's ball game, and now we've got this Shun Kakuta match where, again, obviously Kakuta is going to be favored going in, but it's another Dreamgate match where I'm really unsure of what the result is going to be, and to have that back-to-back months is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I like the idea that Shun, this is the largest remaining show of the year. Shun being able to go hey, so I headlined the two biggest shows of the year, and then also going into the big promotion that's going to be going on with Gate of Miyane, having him be such a figure of Miyane and him being Dreamgate champion, there is a certain level of appeal there that I can't discount when considering his chances in this match.
I don't think, well, I guess it depends on how they do it, but I'm not worried about them killing Kakuta's heat if he loses, because I think there's a lot more to be told in the story. And again, it's a lot like the Yamato match, where I think they could go down either path, and I don't think either path is the wrong choice. One might be a little bit more exciting than the other. In the same way that I thought at World Yamato retaining would be slightly more exciting, I think I'm in the boat of, I kind of think Shun retaining would be a little bit more exciting, even if I'd be, full steam ahead for another Kakuta Dreamgate run, given his performances since May.
Yeah, I just feel like now that it would be after 4 years of Shun as a heel, or virtually 4 years with Shun as a heel, it just seems like it's not really cutting Shun off at the knees, but the catharsis that you get with the face turn, and now, you see the response that was happening for him for just that run in. The audience in Kobe was a different kind of cheering and exciting for when Shun was cutting the promo on Kakuta. It does not, there's a bit of me that goes I want that to really kind of continue and see where that goes. And with the company and the idea of all this is not resorting to necessarily positive business growth, or the ship is still kind of riding before it's changing direction. There's a part of me that thinks that you kind of have to keep it on Shun, because that you have this kind of momentum behind him, that when the ship gets righted, the person that should be at front with the waving the flag has to be Shun Skywalker. So I just don't, no, that's some of the cognitive dissonance that I deal with when I'm trying to consider this, and it's kind of pushed me further in thinking that Shun's going to win.
And I'm kind of with you as we have this conversation, and I'm, maybe Kakuta kills him in 4 minutes now, but it is interesting. Again, the business of Dreamgate this year I find to be so interesting, because I really think this promotion has been booked, minus Jackie Kame, extraordinarily well this year. They are doing, it's a lot like AEW. I think they're doing everything they should be doing to cater to their audience and to grow that audience. And on both fronts, I'm shocked that it's not happening. With Yamato's title reign, it was, okay, we're setting the table for whoever beats him to be the guy that's going to bring fans back to the building. And with Shun, he's not this full-fledged babyface yet. we don't have him in a new unit with a new t-shirt that everybody can go buy. But it almost feels like to me that if they pivot to Kakuta, we're just going to be delaying until the next time that there's a babyface champion. We're going to go, okay, now is when people are going to come back to the building. Because if Kakuta becomes champion, I could see the conversation being like, well, he's a strong heel. Not everybody wants to see that. You know, it's we're really setting up the guy who beats Kakuta. But we just had the guy who beat Yamato, and he's the guy. I think we all agree he's the guy that should be in that position. Let's have him run with us a little bit. And I that's kind of the more we talk, the more I actually think it's closer to 50-50. And the more we talk, I don't know if it's the right move to have Shun win, but I'm certainly more in favor of it.
I just think that you had that Yamato run executed perfectly to hand the football over to Shun. And at least with how the promotion is going and with the current stars and with the idea that everyone's like harebrained idea taken off the table, that's just never going to happen. He is the last next great hope. And I just don't know, like, by the time you get the ball back around to him, because if Kakuta wins, like as we were talking about, it's going to be a little while with that. And who's to say that Shun Skywalker is even going to be in the company at that point? So I think
always a possibility with him. I tell people that all the time. I don't think he's going anywhere, but you can never outright ignore that possibility.
He's 29. That eventually, like, what he's accomplished in his 20s is extraordinary, but it's pretty much out in the open, the difference in Dragon Gate money versus other company potential money there. So is taking the belt away from him, like, basically forecasting that happening? Or is this really kind of cementing the guy that when we think about the promotion, that he's going to be up there with Yamato, Shima, Masaki, Mochizuki? Like, there's a part of me that thinks like that this match result kind of can figure into like those kinds of conversations down the road.
Look, I've said this now for the last 2 years. I think the Mount Rushmore of Dragon Gate is closer and closer to becoming represented by, you know, Shima, Mochi, Shingo, Shun, or Shima, Mochi, Yamato, Shun, or Shima, Mochi, Yoshino, Shun, than a lot of people want to give Shun credit for. And the main thing that he's missing now is not a masquerade, hey, this is a great Dreamgate run, but an iconic Dreamgate run. And whether it's here, or whether it's when he's 33, or whether it's when he's 36, or whether it's when he's 40, you know, I don't know. But it feels like the type of thing that's destined to happen at some point. And as we've seen over the last year, business be bizarrely flat. It's like, all right, let's Shun run with it. You know, let's see what this guy's got right now.
Where we think that case, in our semi-main event, we have the man that has now been beckoned by the power brokers of multiple promotions to go become the ace, as Yuki Yoshioka will be teaming with Dragon Daya's original D Courage, going up against the current Open the Twin Gate champions, Minho Lee, Kota Minora, and Jason Lee.
I feel like it makes all the sense in the world for Daya and Yoshioka to win this match, but more so than I thought, I'm still very hung up on the Kobe World Twin Gate match and not having been in Hyobi the champions. And if your argument is, okay, well, Daya and Yoshioka can beat Jason and Minora, and then Ben and Hyo can beat Daya and Yoshioka, I think that's far less effective of a story than the one of Ben and Hyo beating Z-Brats. So I think Yoshioka's going to win. I think it's the right move. I think Jason Lee's eating a high fly flow, and I think he should. But in the back of my mind, the return to glory for original D-Courage is going to be interrupted by my thought of, why isn't this Ben and Hyo? What more could they have done as a tag team in the brief time they've teamed to not warrant these Twin Gate belts? I don't understand that.
Yeah, and you also kind of have the thing that I've always kind of found interesting about D-Courage, in that you're asking him to go become the ace, and then he's teaming with his best friend for the tag team belts instead of that. And there's a part of me that then goes, well, this is just a step along the way, and then probably come, I don't know, King of Gate time or going into next year, that's when you kind of break him back out as the singles, and then that is the final kind of part of it. But there is a bit of it that it kind of feels like, oh, you're trying to be the guy. Why are you doing this instead of trying to become the guy right now?
I'm less bothered by that just because I like when they make titles feel like big deals. And, you know, they've, for whatever reason, just thrown in the white flag on the Triangle Gate belt for a decade now, a decade plus. So them telling this story with Yoshioka and Yoshioka chasing the Twin Gate belt actually works for me just in terms of the way that, like, all right, if they win, the next Twin Gate match is going to feel like a really big match.
Yeah, and if you kind of look through the Twin Gate, at least going into the modern era of Dragon Gate, these are kind of the two teams you think of. Well, you think about Kota Minoura coming out of quarantine and then being kind of pushed to the moon, and him and Jason Lee finishing out the year and then going into Masquerade as Twin Gate champions, and then them revisiting that reign, and now almost at a point where it's not one of the longest runs in Twin Gate history, but at least in recent years, this is one of the longer ones. It feels like either that or big time. And that's going up against the other team kind of this era. I mean, from the day that they showed up as D-Courage when they, and then the two nights in Cork, and that they kind of ended up with Dragon Dia walking out with both the Brave Gate and the Twin Gate. These are kind of the two teams that when you talk about this division over the last 5 years, maybe you also add in Not Hug there for the last kind of 13 months, maybe. But I do really feel like that this is kind of, in a way, at least as it relates to the Twin Gate division in one way, kind of an era-defining kind of match.
I agree with that. I hadn't really thought about that. I guess I have to do a quick cage match here to figure out if we've had a two-on-two match with these teams, because I do not remember one.
It would not line up because of Rey de Parejas starting when it did, and that that original D-Courage is only teamed in this version of Rey de Parejas. And really, after the end of Masquerade, Jason Lee and Kota Minoura went in completely different directions while D-Courage was ascendant.
Yeah, just mentally, I'm trying to... The only one I can think of is... Well, no, Yoshioka was still Die Inferno at Kobe World 2020. I think that's a first-time match, and I hadn't really considered that, but you're exactly right. These are era-defining tag teams, and teams that have history going back to, you know, in terms of teaming Die and Yoshioka 2022, but history going back to 2020, and Jason and Kota began teaming then as well. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I think that adds like a little special era or a little special flavor to kind of this match being like these kind of teams there. It does, though, getting the belts off of them. You look at Z-Bratz at that point, and then if we kind of are going along with, and I feel like we kind of have a little bit of joint logic going with the Dream Gate and the Twin Gate, do you think that does kind of portend towards maybe the Z-Bratz rebranding coming up pretty soon, if that they are going to be a completely beltless coming out of this show?
I don't. You know, that's almost one of those where it's like, if they win all the belts, it's like, well, there's going to be a rebrand coming soon. If they lose all the belts, well, there's going to be a rebrand coming soon. That's a conversation to have after the fact. I don't know in the moment if one influences the other. I think that's something we'll look back on and go, oh, well, they did this so they can do this. But I don't know which of those that would be.
No, that's entirely fair. That is probably a discussion that we should be having next week, not right now. In a Lucha Clásica, we have the Open the Triangle Gate Championship match. The champions team, Mexico, Flamita, Luis Monte, and Bandido, making their second defense against the challengers from Pro Wrestling NOAH, Los Golpeadores, Dragon Bane, and Alpha Wolf, along with Super Crazy. And as this is a Lucha Clásica, it will be 2 out of 3 falls. I don't think we're doing Captain's Fall in this, just straight 2 out of 3 falls.
I like the concept because I like when Dragon Gate embraces their Mexican roots. I always think that's fun whenever they can do it. If Crazy wasn't in this match, if it was a different third man, I could talk myself into the NOAH trio winning this match. But because I don't see them putting a belt on Crazy, nor do I think they should. which then puts us in a position where Flamita, Monte, and Bendito retain. And I think that in and of itself is super interesting.
Monte's never getting his vacation, is he?
No, he's not. I'm sure he's very happy to be champion and very bummed to not be in Mexico City right now, because I believe this is news for everybody. But, you know, my logic is keep Flamita in Japan for as long as humanly possible. And they're doing that right now. So I'm all for it. And Bendito's on a nice little run here. So hopefully that continues. Get him in super crazy, far apart from one another. Do not let them in the ring at the same time. Bendito, have fun with Alpha Wolf and Dragon Bane. Pretend super crazy is not there.
Yeah, like that is kind of the sticky wicket there. Is you just kind of don't want that could almost be elder crime. Isn't like super crazy like in his late 50s now?
He's very old. And although historically I'm a very big super crazy fan, he is not the fleetest of foot, nor is he a great base, nor is he somebody that Bendito can base for. And when you factor in those things, you are out of options for what Bendito can do with him.
Yeah, I kind of feel like there's a part of me that goes, can you like say that there is a crystal ball too and just throw one of the Noah kids in a mask and just have him come out here?
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just providing ideas here. In a special six-man tag match, we have Dragon Gate versus All Japan Pro Wrestling, as Yamato and Dragon Kid of Paradox will be teaming with Dragon Gate's newest rookie, Kazuma Kimura, versus All Japan Pro Wrestling's Aoyagi brothers, Yuma and Atsuki Aoyagi, along with their own younger wrestler, Ryu Inoue, in a match that was really built by the two young guys just trying to bow up and fight each other. I can't wait to... I really want to see Kimura versus Inoue, guys.
It is my second most anticipated match on the show. I loved the angle in real time, but then breaking it down for my written review and really having it click with me that Yamato was calling in a way a green boy. And so, hey, if you're going to invite one of those to the ring, then we'll invite ours to Dangerous Gate. That really worked for me. So I don't know if this will be a great match. You know, I certainly don't have that expectation going in that we're going to witness a classic trios match by any means. I want this to be rough, and I want this to be ugly, and then I want this to progress to the Doi anniversary show. So I'm very, very excited for this.
Yeah, like I feel like this can really provide the bridge, especially since we don't really know where that Doi show has happened or like where it's airing yet. Like,
Shinjuku Face is where it's happening. We don't know where it's airing, though.
Yeah, it does seem to be kind of an open question here, but... You know, I think for like this kind of match, and also considering the building and the stakes here, bringing in All Japan and like using that furthering like Doi's thing that you're participating in, but adding it onto a show like this, that I feel like that this makes Dangerous Gate just a little bit different, and it gives it a little bit of an edge that I feel like Dangerous Gate often has. Usually it's like a no DQ match or something of that nature, but it kind of helps this one set it apart from just like your normal big show with four title matches on it, I feel like.
Well, it feels like a true to form big show. Now, maybe you can deduct a star from the booking, you know, for the amount of guest stars on this show, but even if it hasn't been, say, Funk Lawler, they have done their best to work a program between Team Mexico and then Alpha Wolf and Dragon Bane. The All Japan thing, again, guest stars, but they did build an angle to it. It's not Hiromu Takahashi in a special challenge singles match. The thing that is shocking to me, again, is that I think this has been a really well-built show. I think it's a show that feels really big. And at least with what we have now, there's no indication that this show will be a box office success. And that, to me, is just crazy.
Maybe, and this could play into all the special guests along with this, the fact that this is, since the end of Sponge Guy, the first Dragon Gate show that has been fully sponsored by Mizukan Kansansu, which is a kind of vinegar. And maybe like that helps like having these extra people in here, but... if that's not pretending at the ticket sales, then what is that really for in the end, I guess?
Yeah, it's a good read on that.
The final title match, but it'll be first on the show. But the final title match we'll be talking about is for the Open the Brave Gate Championship. Ryoya Tanaka will be making a second defense against the first time ever challenging for the Brave Gate. That is 55-year-old Misaki Mochizuki. Ryoya Tanaka called his shot at Buyuden back in July, and then now he's going to face the Iron Man of Dragon Gate in a Brave Gate match. And this one, I mean, it does feel like the cherry on top if Mochizuki gets the Brave Gate, completes everything you could do in this company. But it does feel like that Tanaka's in for a tough night, but he's going to come out of it as remaining champion.
I hope Tanaka retains. For as entertained as I am by this Mochizuki story, I think this Mochizuki story is a one-beat story that ends with Ryoya Tanaka standing tall against him. I think that's the best use for both of these guys. I'm enthralled by this idea of Mochizuki cutting weight at the start of the year, realizing he still had abs, and then cutting even more weight to get down to the Brave Gate title scene. That's classic Dragon Gate. That's the sort of stuff that I love. And I have really, really high expectations for this match because Tanaka's been on a heater this year. Mochizuki has had a quietly good year. Unfortunately, Blue Panther has stolen all of the old guy buzz and old guy shine from Mochi, but don't sleep on Mochi's 2025. He's been great this year, so I'm very excited for this, but I do think Tanaka will retain.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated how Mochi is going to work this. Like, as like a noted wrestling genius, just like the idea of we've seen what he has done in his matches as Dreamgate champion, and especially the match against KZ is always the one that kind of rings out when you talk about the way that Misaki Mochizuki thinks about pro wrestling. I'm just fascinated by the idea of what does a Misaki Mochizuki Brave Gate match look like? And I have no idea. Is it going to just be him? I saw the clip going around him kicking the crap out of Chris Jericho in 95 at a Buko Dojo show. Is it going to be just young? Is he going to try to roll the clock back and just be a karate player and just go full force? Or is he going to be like, I'm going to pick this kid apart and let's see if he can get himself out of it? I don't know, Case, but I find the prospect of what's going to happen on Sunday, either way, how the match goes, like, uniquely fascinating. Like, and I think that's another thing that excites me about this card. There's a lot of just open questions about how these matches could go, or the match itself, like how its approach. And yeah, I as much as I adored UT finally getting the Brave Gate, I feel now instantly more excited about the potential of Misaki Mochizuki in a Brave Gate match than I sadly was when UT was Brave Gate champion, or the idea of UT as being a Brave Gate champion, because this is just something that in my near 20 years of Dragon Gate fandom just never has ever crossed my mind before Ryoya Tanaka called him out for it.
I think the nice thing about this is that you and I have both studied Mochizuki enough to know that whatever his approach is to this match is going to be different than his approach to the Dreamgate match. I think there's a chance that for all the literal thousands of Mochizuki matches that you and I have watched, that this one looks way different than the rest of them. And I think that's a very cool thing to prepare for.
Yeah, I really cannot wait for that. We have a special battle royal. With Sponge Guy, we got toilet cleaning wipes and antiseptics and stuff like this. I wonder what Kantansu is. I think that might be the actual vinegar brand, but I guess the winner of this is going to win like a pallet of vinegar. But it's Ultimo Dragon, BB Hulk, Susumu Yokosuka, Kagatora, Naruki Doi, Strong Machine J, KZ, UT, Benkei, Takashi, Problem Dragon, Punch Tomonaga, Kai, and Yoshiki Kato.
Have fun, gentlemen. This should be enjoyable.
Yeah, the thing most looking forward to is Ho-Ho acting like he won. It's to have all that vinegar and being mad that he can't win all that vinegar.
That is a good point. We'll have to see if he makes his way back to the commentary table before this match is over after being eliminated.
I don't think he's actually in this match.
Say it again?
Ho-Ho's not in this match.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got confused by what you were saying. You're right. He's not in this match, which will then, yeah, that will make him very surly on commentary, which I'll enjoy.
Yeah. But then Ultimo's going to win, and then Ho-Ho's going to be like, no, I don't think I could take Ultimo. So he's going to have all the vinegar. match two, eight-man tag. This time, since Masaaki Mochizuki is busy, he leaves the dojo in the capable hands of his best friend, Don Fuji. Okay, so this can't possibly go wrong. And it'll be Don Fuji leading his friend's charges, Ryu Fuda, Daiki Yanagiuchi, and Akihiro Sahara, against Love and Peace, Hyo, Jackie Kamei, Rita, Masaaki, Mochizuki Jr., who's probably not happy to see his dad's friend across the ring from him.
Why put Love and Peace in a big match? You know, who cares? Match two. I'm sure it'll be fun. I'm sure we'll talk about next week how this was sneaky good and how you should watch this, and then we'll all have to move on with our lives, and then whatever the next big show is, which I think is going to be, the 2 in Osaka, number 2 in November, I'm sure Love and Peace will be in the opening match on that show, so we'll just keep on trucking along. I don't get it. I don't like it, but this is what they're doing.
But hey, we'll be able to say that sneaky good match has Don Fuji in it this time.
Which is a nice plus, absolutely.
Yeah, we're okay with that. And it's not a special singles match, but your only non-title singles match on the show, continuing the disintegration of the Shun Skywalker-led Z-Brats, Ishin going one-on-one against Himare.
Well, I hope this mirrors what they did in Cork and Hall, where they were really physical with one another. I found the tone that Ishin took in that match to be refreshing. I find that Himare is really good at getting his ass kicked, and this hopefully will remind me of, it was Dangerous Gate 2021, I believe, or it might have been Gate of Destiny 2020, because I was watching the show live, but they did an opening match of KZ versus Doi, and everybody was like, oh, that's kind of weird. That's a really, really good opening match for the show. And then they just had a great match to start the show. I'm hoping this one is just a newer version of that.
Yeah, no, it felt like KZ, whenever he was like in those special singles matches, decided to treat it like his own personal Dreamgate match.
Well, he's very good at what he does, and so I'm all for that.
Yeah, no, I'm all for that, as well as I'm all for this Dangerous Gate show. Again, this will be this Sunday from Oda Ward City Gymnasium. It will be on the Dragon Gate Network. Jay and Ho-Ho will have the call. It is a 3 p.m. local time start. That's 2 a.m. on the East Coast, 1 a.m. for us, Case, and 6 for those with Greenwich Mean Time. Do you have any other thoughts on Dangerous Gate before we get out of here, bud?
I do not. It's going to be a fun show. I am going to attempt to watch it live. I might have some plans that get in the way of that, but my plan right now is to be up and tweeting and posting in the Discord about this show and reviewing it, and then having that review up Monday morning, and the podcast, of course, will record next Tuesday at our usual time. So that is the goal. I'm looking forward to it. It should be a very exciting show.
I have a column that I have rolling around in my head that I might have out by Friday, but I think my plan for this is, I love the Sunday big shows because I'll just get up, walk the dogs, and then if I just stay off my phone, then I could just watch it all unspoiled. I just can't do that anymore, man. I wish I was your age and able to stay up till 4 a.m. watching pro wrestling.
Well, a lot of the time now, like, the shows begin when I normally get up anyways. Now, the Sunday shows are a little bit different. They start earlier, so that's kind of harder for me to navigate, but I'll be fine. I'll figure it out.
But we will be back with you on next week to talk all about Dangerous Gate. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. You can follow Case at _inyourcase. I'm at Fujiheya. If you would like to join the discussion, there's the Voices of Wrestling Discord, where there's a great Dragon Gate channel. I think Angry216 just put up like one of my favorite matches of that era. Yeah, this was like a Mad Blanky versus Team Veteran match, and talking about the lead up of Dangerous Gate. There's a lot of stuff happening in the Dragon Gate channel. It's honestly my favorite channel on Discord in general. But also there's the Open the Voice Gate channel. That's where we post our show listings when we do those days, as well as anything else as it relates to Open the Voice Gate. But we'll be back with you next week to talk about Dangerous Gate. Have a good week, everyone. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.